Another great thing about it is from top to bottom, all the characters here are memorable or likable or like intensely sleazy, but they all get a great memorable reaction out of you.
This is the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. A podcast dedicated to raw action analysis.
Ooh, my gosh. For fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be?
Each week, we bring you a new action filmmaker to break down your favorite scenes.
360 off person, round kick the guy from a 360 spin.
Now, introducing your hosts, Darren Tun and Mike Messina.
Welcome back, everyone. Today's episode of the Action Filmmaking Decoded podcast is a special Christmas episode. Today we're going to be going over four movies that includes Die Hard, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, and Home Alone. What do all these movies have in common?
They all take place during Christmas, and I would argue that they are all Christmas movies. I know there's definitely some hot debate about whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie, but I'm always saying that it definitely is.
Yeah, it takes place during the Christmas party, so I'm pretty sure, I think that counts.
It counts.
It doesn't really have like all the Christmas stuff that you would normally see, though. I think the only Christmas part of it about it is the party itself.
That's true. But I would also argue that, you know, that's what makes it such a great Christmas movie. And same thing for like Nightmare Before Christmas. You turn on the channels during the holiday season and you get so many sappy family Christmas movies. And you know, that's great and all, but I want to see some stuff blow up. And nothing makes me appreciate things blowing up more than a time of year where nothing seems to be blowing up. I want explosions. I want gunshots. I want martial arts kicks, especially in that time of year.
You mean by like there's no fireworks?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah. For everyone listening right now, we're going to talk about the first Die Hard. I haven't seen the other Die Hards. I don't know if you have.
Oh, a while ago. I remember two vaguely, but Die Hard 1 is, of course, the classic.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Bruce Willis. Die Hard.
What did you like about this movie? What stood out to you?
As a screenwriter, Die Hard is one of those examples that's often heralded as the perfect screenplay. It is visual. It is everything that efficient storytelling should be, where every scene leads into another one and you can't remove any scene without disrupting the flow of the story because everything fits so perfectly. And then, of course, everything you have about our main character, played by Bruce Willis, John McClane, who famously was not everyone's favorite pick for an action movie star. But of course, the character of John McClane isn't necessarily the big Arnold Schwarzenegger type, right? He's a cop, but he's this everyday sort of relatable man. And you have that grounding aspect of him and his relationship. He's trying to win back the heart of his ex-wife, which, again, really makes him relatable. And even little things like the whole famous motif of him being barefoot, having to run through glass and stuff like that. You set that up even in the first shot and you start humanizing him even in the first scene when he's on the airplane. And you have this potentially macho cop then have to stand up and get from the overhead compartment a really, really big, goofy looking fluffy teddy bear. And he's scared of flying and all this stuff. So it's like he really is a human being. And that is the greatest foundation for a good action star, in my opinion.
Yeah, I feel like that movie at the very, very beginning, I really thought that he was like this like CIA type guy. Like I saw him as more of like more trained. But then I was like, oh, he's just this everyday cop, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I think you realize that, you know, pretty quick in the movie. But I like the way it starts out. You know, he goes in the limousine and then takes that ride. And then the driver, I forgot what the driver's name was, but
I forget
he was like,
too. Yeah, another great thing about it is from top to bottom, all the characters here are memorable or likable or like intensely sleazy, but they all get a great memorable reaction out of you.
Yeah, it definitely had that comedic aspect too that I normally like from like older action movies.
Yeah, and even the henchmen too. Like if it's comedic or just characterizing them, it's insane that you could basically tell each of their henchmen apart from the bad guy clan here. And even little details. I remember there's one shot of a dude when he's taking cover behind the candy store shelving. He reaches up to grab a candy bar. He takes one, looks at it, and then he throws it away because it's not the one that he wanted. And then later on, you see him. He finally finds the candy bar of his choice. Such a cool little moment.
Damn, I totally missed that.
It's so small, but it's so endearing for, again, even bad guys.
I just remember the bad guys had these long flowing hair.
Oh, yeah.
Flowing German hair.
The blonde guy.
blonde guy. Yeah, yeah. But I remember a lot of them had like long hair. Man, it was very, very 80s.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I was looking at some of the firefights. You see, you know, nowadays you have John Wicks, you have Extraction and stuff like that. And it's totally new school, choreographed, long takes. But going back to this, it is that simple. It's almost like shooting a conversation traditionally, where it's just a shot of someone shooting and then a reverse shot of all the damage being done. Very effective, though, here. Like, it seems super simple, and it is, sort of, but in the right hands, it really pulls through, even here.
It was very, very, like, simple action choreography, but it was good. You know, they had those wide shots, too, to really give, like, emphasize what was going on in the scene. I really liked that there weren't too many, like, shaky cam shots. It was very, very understandable. The shootouts were great, too. The squibs that they had. Mm-hmm.
So many squibs.
You can literally just see them just like popping off like all over. I really like their attention to detail there in this scene.
Yeah, and you have that bright red sort of a blood choice that they went for.
Yeah.
And it's not gross or anything. It just adds to the action and the fun sort of nature of it.
I'm wondering, did they build like a miniature of this building?
I don't know. I know some of it was definitely built on set. I believe it's like the Fox headquarters building or something like that they used.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
It really looked like they blew the place up. Like,
yeah, and a lot of it was practical explosions and stuff for the wide shots of the building, things like that.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely looked like that. I was just thinking about when you just said every shot is on purpose, because I remember they just did this cutaway back to when his foot was bleeding. And they made it very like intentional that, oh yeah, he stepped on glass and now he's coming into like the bathroom area. I think this was after the shootout with Alan Rickman and
the guy.
Yeah, they're like, shoot the glass. And then because they saw that he was barefoot.
Yeah, and halfway through you have a shot of his face, he looks down, and the camera has to tilt down. And then that's when the audience can really put one and two together, or two and two together,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, that's why Alan Rickman's shooting the glass.
Yeah. But speaking of, I was like, he was barefoot the whole movie, you know, like,
yeah,
that was crazy. I forgot. How did he end up barefoot the whole movie? He was just walking around in the office, right? At the very
beginning. It was something like, I forget exactly what, but I think he went off with his ex-wife to talk to her and something happened where, I don't know if they were in like her room or something where his shoes were off. And that's when the terrorists start to take over. So he was just without shoes on, I guess.
Man, that's so interesting.
It's crazy. It's pretty crazy. I remember in that first scene, it's when he was scared of flying. The dude next to him goes, oh, if you're scared of flying, right when you get back and when you're stressed out, take off your shoes and just like scrunch your toes on the carpet. And it helps a whole bunch.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Again, humanizing thing to make him scared of flying in the very first scene of the movie. And then that's, I believe, what motivated him to take off those shoes, which is, again, humanizing him right off the bat.
Yeah. What did you think of Alan Rickman as a bad guy here?
Oh, he's great. You know, he was big in theater and everything beforehand, this. And this is his big film Hollywood breakout role. He's amazing. He's incredible. He has that one bit where he meets John McClane, where he meets Bruce Willis, and he starts faking, improvising that American accent.
Yeah, yeah.
It was phenomenal.
He was like, are you one of them? And I was like, damn, I didn't think it was gonna go that way. But
it was a really good twist. That's actually, I saw a video about it from Movie Bob on YouTube, who's great. Everyone should watch his stuff if you don't already. And he's talking about how the reason the movie is fun and lighthearted partly is because you have all the information. You're not like holding your breath to see what the bad guys have in store. You know what the bad guys are doing. You know what John McClane is up to. And that basically holds true up until that one point. And there's one exception, which is when you have Bruce Willis, John McClane, he knows that Hans Gruber is actually the bad guy right next to him. And you don't get that payoff. And the audience doesn't realize that until both of them reveal that to each other.
Yeah, that shootout, though, was pretty cool. But backtracking, I want to talk about the very first shootout. I think that was the one in the same room where the CEO died.
Takagi, Mr. Takagi.
I remember seeing a breakdown of that scene, and then I was like, this is the scene.
And it's interesting, again, that they're cutting back to John McClane's point of view for that, pretty much, by going on the other side of the window or the door where he was.
Right, right. And then he returns to that same spot for that second shootout. It's kind of funny. Everyone in this movie, like, around John McClane kind of makes these stupid decisions, and you're like, no.
Yeah, yeah, no. That's true.
Especially with the police in this movie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And they send the one guy, the one cop, to go check everything out.
I think Roger Ebert, the famous reviewer, when he saw Die Hard, he at first really didn't like it. And a big reason was because the cops were so inept, is what he said. And then later on, he backtracked and said, oh, no, actually, it's really good.
Yeah, but that scene, man, where the cop is just driving around in circles and he's like, nothing, I don't see anything there. I was like, come on. Like, that was like the one scene where he can get the whole entire police force like attention. And the one guy was just going to leave. So he just threw the body over the side of the building.
Yeah. Another example, actually, of where for a split second, you don't know what's about to happen because you had, you know, you don't see John McClane throwing the body out the window. You just get the
payoff. Yeah, you just get that shot with the police car, right? And then it just comes down. Yeah. And then he starts firing. He's just like, ah, and he goes straight into the back fence, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I have some fun facts, too, if you're ready for me to read some off.
Yeah, yeah, let's do that.
Let me see. So these are all taken from IMDb, pretty much. First one. When John McClane runs through the glass shards in his bare feet after Hans shoots out the glass with his men in the computer room, Bruce Willis is wearing special rubber shoes designed to look like his own bare feet. You can see this if you're looking closely, as his feet appear quite unnaturally large in some of these crucial barefoot scenes. I did not notice this, but I'm definitely going to rewatch it.
I think it was just look at that.
Yeah, wow. It was. Maybe there's probably some other scenes where you might be able to see it, but I'll take a look out for that. Foot to man ratio.
Wow. And that was just because he was actually just stepping on the glass there, right?
Yeah.
What was it? Look, it was a rubber like encasing, or it was like an actual shoe?
It must have been like some kind of shoe if he's running over actual glass.
Mm.
Maybe there's some more stuff about it online.
Yeah, definitely got to look into that.
In the original script, like the original novel, the action took place over 3 days, but John McTiernan was inspired to have it take place over a single night by Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Mm.
So Shakespeare's been gone for quite a while, still influencing great stories here.
Yep.
Jeb Stuart was having difficulty writing the screenplay until he had a near-death experience while driving at night in Los Angeles after a fight with his wife. He was driving behind a truck carrying refrigerators, and one of the fridge boxes fell out of the truck. Luckily, the box was empty, but he realized that if he died, he wouldn't have been able to apologize to his wife. This inspired him to give clear motivations to John McClane and Holly's characters. They wanted to reunite with each other after having a fight. That's crazy. I'm glad that the fridge did not take out Jeb Stuart here. But that's such, to me, that is one of the key things that makes Die Hard special and such a perfect action film, is that you have that very humanizing relationship and clear relationship between John and Holly throughout the whole film.
Yeah, I was actually very surprised because they didn't do like any crazy setup, but you still really felt for the characters.
Definitely. Again, it was like, it's just enough. It's that efficiency of this screenplay that is so incredible. It is just enough to make you care wholeheartedly about them.
The scenes are very specific and selective, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The fireball in the elevator shaft was shot with real pyrotechnics using a miniature shaft. The camera speed had to vary over the length of the shot because otherwise the fireball would appear to change speed as it moved up the forced perspective model. The effects people weren't sure exactly what rate to vary the speed, so they rigged a manual variable speed control and did several takes, changing the speed at different rates, and then picked the one that looked best.
It's a gun? What is it? Like?
So it sounds like, yeah, it sounds like they had a mini shaft recreated that they could blow up. But then to make it look longer than it was, they had one end smaller than the other end, so it looked a lot longer. And then it sounds like they had something rigged up to the camera where the frame rate, I believe, would change automatically per second. Because if they didn't change the frame rate, I think you would be able to tell that the flames were moving. It would look like the flames are moving at a changing speed because the size of the shaft is changing. It's not actually a straight shaft.
Hmm. So it was like a mixture of practical effects and in-camera effects.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's very inventive.
Now we might want to move on to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
It's not my fault. Just shut up and run.
Hold it right there.
Harry was a small-time crook.
Oh, boy.
Till he opened the door.
Oh, no, no, we're not ready for your audition.
Just take him, he's ready. You ready, right?
To a really big break.
Quit acting like the good guy. You got your partner killed. You killed him.
So I just saw Kiss Kiss Bang Bang today. I was definitely aware of it for a long time. I just never got around to seeing it. Directed by Shane Black, taking place, of course, like all of Shane Black's works, taking place at Christmas time, starring Iron Man and Batman, basically. You have Robert Downey Jr. and Kilmer in the other.
They were both really funny in this movie.
Oh, they were phenomenal. The dialogue is, I would say, Tarantino level in this work and in a lot of Shane Black's works. You have that really buddy cop one-on-one sort of dialogue in pretty much a lot of what he does. You know, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, it reminded me of quite a bit of Big Lebowski, which is not an action movie at all, but just subverting all those expectations around that detective pseudo-noir genre, they reminded me of each other quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely. And what is Gay Perry again to Robert Downey Jr.'s character?
Yeah, so Robert Downey Jr., he's a thief who sort of stumbles into an audition and then is able to make it to Hollywood, almost landing a big role.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and Perry is, played by Val Kilmer, is a private investigator who will do consulting for a lot of the films. So Robert Downey Jr. sent on assignment as an actor in order to sort of gain some experience to bring into his acting talents.
And then they just kind of stumble onto this whole murder scene.
Yeah, then they get sucked into this whole big world of intrigue.
Yeah, I really liked Val Kilmer's like sarcastic humor in this film.
It was great. They make Robert Downey Jr.'s character so endearing in a lot of ways in those first 20 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
Having a guy that quick-witted, sometimes it can be difficult to do that. One great way to do that, though, is to have someone who's even quicker-witted and even more on the know than him as your other lead. So having Val Kilmer sort of balance out the snarkiness of Robert Downey Jr. really helped there.
I love that joke where he was like, if you looked up idiot or something like that, you know what you'd see? And then picture of me? Like, no, the definition of idiot.
Perfect. There's so many, too. There's so many punchlines in the dialogue where you don't really get the screen time or the filmic language appreciating and stopping to appreciate that comedic beat or that punchline. But it's just every other line is so clever and so witty.
Yeah. I think the only real, like, big action piece in this is towards the end. I think we could break that down.
Yeah, so you have a final sort of chase sequence leading into a firefight, right? And we somehow end up in this crazy situation where there's a casket with a dead body dangling off of a bridge by another highway. And you have Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer having to come in and try and save the day. First of all, you have Val Kilmer getting shot. And Val Kilmer in the film is the guy who knows what's up, knows how to handle a gun. And now you have Robert Downey Jr. all alone. And you have the bad guys circling around in their car about to come for him and the female lead, whose name escapes me, actually, for a second.
Harmony, right?
Yes, yes, thank you. So she was great in Source Code as well. But so the car's coming around, and Robert Downey Jr. has to leap out of the way of another car and winds up dangling from the arm, sticking out of this casket, dangling right above a highway. And you have a shootout where he shoots the main villain above him, and then he has to shoot an oncoming car of bad guys coming below him. And just to remind everyone, throughout the rest of the film, prior to the scene, RDJ, he isn't this stone cold killer. He's a guy in over his head. He's a likable, almost naive character, despite being really quick-witted. And he has to kill one or two people before this, and he's really torn up about it. He's really shaken about seeing people die, about seeing bodies, about having to kill people in self-defense. And here you have him having to sort of bury all that and come out on top. So after he shoots the guys in the oncoming car below him, he drops down from that casket above the highway, lands on the roof of the car.
Yeah, that's crazy. Where he's just hanging off the side and he's shooting him in the car.
Yeah, I wonder if for the wide shots, if that was RDJ or if they had a stunt team doing that.
They probably did.
I would imagine so, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm just saying his accuracy with those shots were pretty good, hanging from a sign and
that's true.
Shooting the guy in a moving car.
And he lost a finger at some point in this movie.
So
all this with 9 digits. It's crazy.
Also, not to mention his coordination when he drops onto the car as it's moving. That was crazy.
And one of my favorite bits of the action choreography in this movie coming right then, when you have the two bad guys still alive in the car, so they come out and try to shoot him while he's on top of the car. He's able to pop one guy right away. Then he has to roll over on the roof of the car to get an angle to stick his arm inside the car and shoot the guy that way.
Yeah, because the guy was shooting through the roof, right?
Right, right. It was very interesting geometry for a shootout, even if it is only 2-3 people in that one.
Right.
And another little foreshadowing thing that happens is Val Kilmer gets shot in a shootout and the bullet passes through him and hits RDJ as well. And that's right before this whole sequence happens. Then at the very end of this sequence, you have Robert Downey Jr. reveal that, oh, he got shot, but he had a book in his pocket, and that stopped the bullet in this sort of movie cliche moment. But then we immediately subvert that expectation. Yeah, it went through the book, just like how the bullet went through Val Kilmer and hit RDJ. So it's some foreshadowing there as well, that we're going to subvert expectations in this way.
I think it was very, very like witty.
I can read off some fun facts here as well.
Yeah, let's do that.
In reference to the Ike, Mike, and Mustard quote from the movie, Mike and Ike are boxed candies in mixed colors of black and white and are often used as diner slang for salt and pepper shakers. And pre-1950s, Ike, Mike, and Mustard joke was an off-color joke, generally with sexual innuendo, that wouldn't be told in polite or mixed company. And this is, there's one scene where RDJ is being held up by two goons, and one of them says, oh, it's Ike, Mike, and Mustard. And then his goon friend says, "What? This isn't the 50s, what are you talking about? No one understands that reference." So more of that back and forth humor that's really signature to Shane Black.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers was willing to produce the movie with a larger budget if Harrison Ford was to play the detective. When he passed on it, a bunch of people were considered before Val Kilmer landed the role. And also for our other main character, Johnny Knoxville was set to star as Harry before being replaced by Robert Downey Jr., who at the time, of course, was a bit of a wild card, Robert Downey Jr., because he just gotten out of prison. So he was not a favorite in a lot of studios' eyes. But picturing this with Johnny Knoxville and Harrison Ford is very different than what we got.
That would have been a very interesting dynamic, for sure.
It would. I think that's it. I think this is a good transition into Iron Man 3.
I can't sleep. And when I do, I have nightmares. Honestly, there's 100 people who want to kill me. I hope I can protect the one thing I can't live without.
All right, let's talk Iron Man 3. Iron Man 3, another Shane Black movie, also taking place during Christmas, like we said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what did you think about this film as the third film in the Iron Man franchise?
You know, the Iron Man franchise specifically had a kind of rough time with the main trilogy, at least. Iron Man 1, fantastic. Iron Man 2, not as great in my opinion. That was written, I believe, during a writer's strike, so it definitely had some bumps in the road narratively there. I know a lot of people have a lot of issues with Iron Man 3. Again, I guess kind of similar to Rian Johnson in Star Wars with subverting expectations. But I personally love this movie. There's definitely some things that are not my favorite about it, but I love what happens with the character of Tony Stark. I love how you're really dealing with a very humanizing trauma, similar to what is done in Die Hard, where you're humanizing this superpowered main character, stripping him of what makes him... Yeah. powerful physically or quote-unquote special, and getting down to the bare elements of what makes Tony Stark Tony Stark.
Yeah, because they really take everything away from him in this movie. I think that was kind of their goal.
Even like down to, of course, he's a very smart character in the Marvel universe, but then even giving him those emotional and mental panic attacks, it's almost even taking away that from him and really forcing him to reinvent himself from the ground up. Very Shane Black to have that damaged sort of a main character.
Yeah, I think that was one of the very first times that they were doing that within, especially the Iron Man franchise, where he has that panic attack in the restaurant, the bar, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely love when the little kid goes up to him and asks him to sign the little crayon drawing he made. And yeah. Robert, he goes, "I loved you in A Christmas Story." Because obviously the little kid isn't understanding that joke. And yeah. Tony Stark's just the guy who's cracking jokes for himself to make himself laugh.
Yeah, I found this movie a lot more humorous. The first one did have a lot of humor, though. But
it did, yeah.
This one's definitely set up for like a lot of slapstick type humor.
Just like a lot of Shane Black works.
Yeah, I think this movie in particular had some pretty cool scenes. The one scene that I remember from this movie, it's the scene where his house actually gets attacked. And then there's like this giant explosion. The whole house just goes underwater. But I really like how he sees it first on the TV and then the missile is coming at him. And then like, bam, he just turns and he sees it in real life. I always wonder, like, why were they recording that? like his house just getting exploded. Like, nobody told him. He was just chilling there.
Where are his real friends at? Come on.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And Jarvis didn't say anything. No one said anything.
Oh, just... that's true. Of all people, Jarvis, the friggin' house robot, should be flashing red lights or something.
But it was still a pretty awesome scene because it was like, man, the whole place is just getting destroyed.
Definitely. And again, such a personal story for Tony Stark here, hitting him literally at his home where he lives.
Yeah, where he thinks that he's safe.
And I guess that also sets up the very last shot of the film, right? Where you have that overhead shot of him returning to his house, to the rubble that's still there and just salvaging whatever he can.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of correlation with those two. But man, this scene is crazy because I think this movie is probably one of the first movies to introduce the Iron Man suit that kind of comes apart and then pieces together.
Setting up the stages definitely for Age of Ultron and that whole Tony Stark narrative arc.
I think this suit, though, just gives Shane Black a lot of comedic room to just play around with, you know? It's not functioning properly, like they're just flying out of nowhere, you know? It's kind of like this cool, like, tech thing, but it's not exactly functioning just how he wants to. So, you know, there's a lot of room for jokes there.
Yeah, and of all the Iron Man films, I think this one really does the most with that suit concept, and it's able to change it up in that interesting way, like, to get, again, really funny, but also really tense action scenes. I mentioned that I really love is when you have Tony Stark tied to the bed frame. He has two goons and a bunch of goons behind them watching over him. And he's able to call in his pieces from a ways away. They're flying in through the window, but it takes a couple seconds in between each piece landing. So he's having to constantly slowly turn the table on these henchmen, where first his hand comes in, then he gets one like left foot boot from his suit. And one by one, each piece comes in more and more.
Right. I think I just found that really interesting. Like, they just have to choreograph these scenes, and like, how would Iron Man function if it was just this one part? How would he function if he only had a jetpack on one foot?
And just how that would change the physics of how he spins and how he can boost himself up. It was really interesting visually in that way.
And I think that just happens throughout the movie, right? He has these little parts of the suit right on him, like the hand.
And it's also him not having a full suit of armor means that he's susceptible to bullets too. So it's able to give these normal hero level life and death stakes when he is going after just guys with guns who would seem like just cannon fodder in any other superhero movie, but here can add some tension to a scene.
Definitely kind of feels naked without the suit.
Yeah, and you also have in the Spider-Man movie, Homecoming, the first Spider-Man movie in that Marvel Cinematic Universe, you have Iron Man popping out of the suit and Tony Stark saying, if you are nothing without a suit, then you shouldn't have it. And he's referencing Spider-Man there, who he's like mentoring. But that hits so hard because you're using the Cinematic Universe really to its fullest potential, where you're backing up that single resonating line with an entire like 120 minutes of other screen time and character development.
But man, back on that scene though, where his house was getting destroyed, I found it really interesting how that suit went to Pepper first.
Yeah, yeah. And you have Tony making that choice. And that's a huge character thread of the film, right? Is his relationship with his suits and Iron Man, and then his relationship with Pepper and how sacrificing one in order to save the other, it has this complex dynamic.
Yeah, and then he blows up all the suits in the end.
But I'm pretty sure in that final sequence, I saw one suit have to like position himself to hold up the whole rig that they're on. So if that guy blew up, everything's going down. Everything's in the ocean at that point.
Oh man, and there's actually one other part of this suit though that's pretty cool. The whole underwater sequence when he gets crushed by the house and the suit's filling up with water. I would think that it was waterproof.
I would think so, yeah. And let me see, I have some fun facts here if you're ready for them.
Yeah, let's bring them on.
So Tony Stark strikes a Mook Jung, or a Wing Chun wooden dummy. Robert Downey Jr. has been training in Wing Chun for several years under Sifu Eric Oram, and also used these skills in Sherlock Holmes in 2009. And of course, at this point, the sequel to Sherlock Holmes as well. This reminds me of Bruce Lee so much.
Wow.
Just in that you have an actor who's actually skilled in a certain art, actually in Wing Chun itself, right? Which connects directly to Bruce Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And he's bringing those skills out as his character.
He comes in pre-trained.
Yeah. And you saw some of that in Iron Man 2 as well. You have a scene with him and Jon Favreau sort of just like hitting mitts or whatever.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think martial arts in general has helped him get through some personal things in his life as well.
Nice. I didn't know that.
According to producer Kevin Feige, once again, every Marvel Cinematic Universe Phase 2 movie has an homage to Star Wars in the form of a character losing an arm. In this movie, you have Aldrich Killian losing an arm during the battle with Tony Stark. In Captain America Winter Soldier, Bucky loses an arm during his fall from the train, and the list goes on and on. Everyone's losing an arm at some point in these films.
So that's like a little Easter egg there.
Yeah, definitely. And it seems like they cheated a little bit in Ant-Man because an arm shrinks instead of falling off. But we'll let that one slide.
Ah, I see.
All right, I got one more fun fact.
Okay.
The post-credit scene was originally meant to have Tony Stark blasting off into space to meet the Guardians of the Galaxy. Iron Man was going to have a cameo role in Guardians of the Galaxy, also an homage to his being the Guardians' latest member in the comics at that time.
Mm-hmm.
This was scrapped when RDJ said he may not reprise his role as Tony Stark in the future. So instead, Dr. Bruce Banner or Mark Ruffalo, the Hulk, appeared in the post-credit scene. I feel like it wouldn't really fit if Tony Stark were going into space at the end of this movie. I think what they went with definitely works with what they had a lot better.
It's better, yeah. I feel like we can't finish this movie until we do the Mandarin's mansion scene really quick.
Oh, yes, yes.
There's this really cool sequence of him going to the hardware store and building like his makeshift weapons.
Yeah, almost Home Alone-esque.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about that plot twist with the Mandarin reveal?
Yeah. How do you feel about that Ben Kingsley and then the Guy Pearce switch?
A lot of people feel some type of way about this. Mm. I am totally fine with the switcheroo. The only thing is, I wasn't crazy about Guy Pearce being the replacement bad guy for the whole thing. I feel like that stuff could have been a little more compelling. And there's also the whole like Asian Orientalism aspect to the Mandarin character that's always been kind of a problem with him. So that was difficult to navigate, I'm sure, for the writers. But I kind of love the Ben Kingsley scene. It's so funny and so out of left field.
Yeah, he has that British accent, right?
I'm an actor, I'm Trevor. And he falls asleep halfway through a sentence. Love Ben Kingsley. Fantastic.
I think we can move on to Home Alone.
Have yourself.
I have a terrible feeling. Did you lock up?
Yeah.
Do we set the timers on the lights?
Mm-hmm. What else could we be forgetting?
Our troubles will be ours.
Kevin!
Home Alone.
Man, the first Home Alone. This came out in 1990.
That's crazy. That is several years before I was born.
Just about 9 years before I was born.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Great Christmas movie. But I think we are going to kind of dive into the stunts, more or less the torture sequences.
I guess, yeah, this is a torture sequence.
We have Joe Pesci knocking on the door and he gets shot right in the groin, point blank. How do you think they did that?
They probably didn't tell Joe Pesci and then they just pulled him. Right. That's probably what happened. That's how I would do it, yeah.
Yep. Just walk through the house and we have all these great things set up.
Just take a tour of the set, Joe Pesci. Make sure everything's in order before we shoot.
You have the cameras just set up, rolling.
Yeah.
Be candid right here, you know?
Let it rip.
Yeah.
I imagine the BB gun was not actually firing anything.
Mm.
I imagine that's just Joe Pesci acting like Joe Pesci.
Probably like a blank or something like that. That looked like it definitely hurt a lot.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I feel like half of these things could be like Mortal Kombat finishing moves that happen to them. It is absolutely brutal. And because it's practical, you really feel the impact for everything that happens. I think Brian Altano, who's like a video game journalist, describes this movie as live action Looney Tunes.
Mm.
And it 100% is. That is the most accurate way to describe this movie.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Yeah, it'd be bad in real life. You have this scene where Marv is turning the faucet and then he gets electrocuted for a couple seconds. And you have the camera cut from him being electrocuted to a skeleton in his place being electrocuted. Back to him, the actor.
Yeah, yeah.
It's perfect. I did not expect that in a live action movie, but there it was. It is like a cartoon come to life.
Man, I want to talk about that torch scene. Joe Pesci really stays there for a long time with that torch.
He really does. When he's walking in the house, you mean?
Yeah, when he walks into the house. We're just like on him for like a straight 5 seconds. And he's just like, ah! Man, and they do a cut-in on him too.
I can't believe Joe Pesci like took all these injuries for this. It's crazy. I can't believe he actually let them, like, they're throwing irons at their faces. It's amazing.
Yeah. Man, I think the most painful looking scene was definitely the nail in the foot.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. It looked like a perspective thing there where his foot was like in front of the nail.
And then just adding that sound effect a little bit. Brutal. Brutal.
I feel like this is one of those movies that as a kid, it makes you wonder like, oh man, can I really do this?
Can I really take two grown men coming into the house?
Yeah.
There's actually this like part of a technique in jiu-jitsu called the Home Alone, because you have to put your two hands against your face, palm side in, like Kevin McAllister on the cover of Home Alone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Do you think we're ready for some fun facts here?
Yeah, let's do some fun facts.
So here we go. Joe Pesci deliberately avoided Macaulay Culkin on set because he wanted Culkin to think he was mean.
Hmm.
In the scene when Kevin walks past the driveway just as Harry and Marv are driving down it and stop just in time to stop hitting him, they achieved that effect by having Macaulay Culkin walk backwards as the van was driven in reverse away from him. Then they played the footage backwards in the final cut.
Oh, wow. I didn't notice that.
That worked really well. It never looked weird to me. Mm-hmm. And I guess that makes sense. You know, it'd probably be bad for your reputation if you ran over a small child on your last film.
And wasn't that like a first-person perspective too?
I know there was a shot from in the car, and I don't know if there was one from Kevin's point of view.
Mm.
But we got pretty close.
Yeah.
So I definitely could tell it was practical.
If you don't got to hurt him, you don't have to.
Soon after this movie, Hilary Wolf, who played the sister Megan, quit acting and became a member of the U.S. Olympic judo team. of course, as action filmmakers, as martial artists. Fantastic fun fact.
Yeah.
So if we could get Megan Hillary Wolf on the podcast, that would probably be a dream come true.
Oh, yeah.
All right, I got one more fun fact. This one's a bit of a mouthful, but I think it's 100% worth it. There is a legend that Elvis Presley, who died in 1977, made a cameo in this movie. Many of those who believe that Elvis is still alive maintained that the heavily bearded man standing in the background of the scene where Mrs. McAllister is shouting at the desk clerk just before she meets John Candy is Elvis. They asserted for years that the man is in the correct age range because Elvis would have been around 55 at the time. He makes a head movement that Elvis frequently made during concerts, and that no record has ever been found about this particular actor's participation in the movie. Mm. The theory was finally debunked in 2018 when investigative journalists identified the extra as Gary Richard Grott, who had passed away from a heart attack in February 2016, and Grott's family also confirmed that Grott was in fact in Home Alone.
Mm.
Crazy. I don't know if I buy this. I feel like Elvis might still be kicking.
Yeah.
Might have been in this movie.
Wow. What a coincidence that there's no more evidence there.
I know, it's too convenient. And what a coincidence. Gary Richard Grott supposedly played this extra and then he just passes away before we can get to him.
Yeah.
It's a little convenient for me, but that remains to be seen.
I feel like Chris Columbus would know.
That's true. Once we get Chris Columbus on the show, then we'll be able to ask him point blank, where is Elvis Presley? That's it for Home Alone fun facts.
Alrighty.
I think that's about it. Yeah, it was a great holiday special.
Hope you guys enjoyed listening to this episode. Let us know if you have any other movies you want us to break down.
Yeah, it was really fun breaking down movies as a little change in the formula for the show. If you like it, let us know. And we'll be back with our normal interviews next week with our next episode.
Yep. All right, guys. Have a happy holidays and stay safe.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe and leave a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the podcast app of your choice. You can find us at actiondecoded.com or on Instagram at Action Filmmaking Podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.